seeing turtles. I like to watch the sun come up as well. It was like watching a maiden rising naked from her bath. Some might be prettier than others, but everyone was full of promise. The turtles have their charms, I will allow. Nothing delights me so much as the sight of a nice pair of shapely, shells. Scepter L'Amour laughed. Like everyone else aboard the Shy Maid, she had her secrets. She was welcome to them. I do not want to know her. I only want to fuck her. She knew it too, as she hung a scepter's crystal about her neck to nestle in the cleft between her breasts. She teased him with a smile. Yandri pulled up the anchor, slid one of the long poles off the cabin roof, and pushed them off. Two of the herons raised their heads to watch as the Shy Maid drifted away from the bank, out into the current. Slowly the boat began to move downstream. Yandri went to the tiller. Ysilla was turning the biscuits. She laid an iron pan atop the brazier and put the bacon in. Some days she cooked biscuits and bacon, some days bacon and biscuits. Once every fortnight there might be a fish, but not today. When Ysilla turned her back, Tyrion snatched a biscuit off the brazier, darting away just in time to avoid a smack from her fearsome wooden spoon. They were best when eaten hot, dripping with honey and butter. The smell of the bacon cooking soon fetched Duck up from the hold. He sniffed over the brazier, received a swack from Ysilla's spoon, and went back to have his morning piss off the stern. Tyrion waddled over to join him. "Now here's a sight to see," he quipped as they were emptying their bladders. "A dwarf and a duck, making the mighty roin that much mightier." Yandri snorted in derision. "Mother Roin has no need of your water, Yellow. She's the greatest river in the world." Tyrion shook off the last few drops. "Big enough to drown a dwarf, I grant you. The Manda is as broad, though. So is the Trident near its mouth. The black water runs deeper."
"You do not know the river. Wait, and you will see."
The bacon turned crisp, the biscuits golden brown. Young Griff stumbled up onto deck, yawning. "Good morrow, all." The lad was shorter than Duck, but his lanky bill suggested that he had not yet come into his full growth. "This beardless boy could have any maiden in the Seven Kingdoms, blue hair or no. Those eyes of his would melt them." Like his sire, young Griff had blue eyes, but where the father's eyes were pale, the son's were dark. By lamplight they turned black, and in the light of dusk they seemed purple. His eyelashes were as long as any woman's.
"I smell bacon," the lad said, pulling on his boots. "Good bacon," said Ysilla. "Sit."
She fed them on the afterdeck, pressing honeyed biscuits on young Griff and hitting Duck's hand with her spoon whenever he made a grab for more bacon. Tyrion pulled apart two biscuits, filled them with bacon, and carried one to Yandri at the tiller. Afterward he helped Duck to raise the Shy Maid's big lateen sail. Yandri took them out into the centre of the river, where the current was strongest. The Shy Maid was a sweet boat. Her draught was so shallow she could work her way up even the smallest of the river's vassal streams, negotiating sandbars that would have stranded larger vessels. Yet with her sail raised and a current under her, she could make good speed. That could mean life and death on the upper reaches of the Roin, Yandri claimed.
"There's no law above the Sorrows, not for 1,000 years.
And no people, as far as I can see."
He glimpsed some ruins along the banks, piles of masonry overgrown by vines and moss and flowers, but no other signs of human habitation.
"You do not know the river, Yellow. A pirate boat may lurk up any stream and escape slaves oft hide among the ruins. The slave catchers seldom come so far north."
"Slave catchers would be a welcome change from turtles."
Not being an escaped slave, Tyrion need not fear being caught, and no pirate was like to bother a pole boat moving downstream. The valuable goods came up the river from Volantis.
When the bacon was gone, Duck punched young Griff in the shoulder.
"Time to raise some bruises. Swords today, I think."
"Swords?"
young Griff grinned.
"Swords will be sweet."
Tyrion helped him dress for the bout, in heavy breeches, padded doublet, and a dinted suit of old steel plate. Sir Raleigh shrugged into his mail and boiled leather. Both set helms upon their heads, and chose blunted longswords from the bundle in the weapons chest. They set to on the afterdeck, having at each other lustily whilst the rest of the morning company looked on. When they fought with mace or blunted long-axe, Sir Raleigh's greater size and strength would quickly overwhelm his charge. With swords the contests were more even. Neither man had taken up a shield this morning, so it was a game of slash and parry, back and forth across the deck. The river rang to the sounds of their combat. Young Griff landed more blows, though Duck's were harder. After a while, the bigger man began to tire. His cuts came a little slower, a little lower. Young Griff turned them all and launched a furious attack that forced Sir Raleigh back. When they reached the stern, the lad tied up their blades and slammed a shoulder into Duck, and the big man went into the river. He came up sputtering and cursing, bellowing for someone to fish him out before a snapper ate his privates. Tyrion tossed a line to him. "Duck should swim better than that," he said as he and Yandry were hauling the knight back aboard the Shy Maid. Sir Raleigh grabbed Tyrion by the collar. "Let us see our dwarf swim," he said, chucking him headlong into the Rhône. The dwarf laughed last. He could paddle passably well, and did, until his legs began to cramp. Young Griff extended him a pole. "You are not the first to try and drown me," he told Duck, as he was pouring river water from his boot. "My father threw me down a well the day I was born, but I was so ugly that the water witch who lived down there spat me back." He pulled off the other boot, then did a cartwheel along the deck, spraying all of them. Young Griff laughed. "Where did you learn that?" "The mummers taught me," he lied. "My mother loved me best of all her children because I was so small. She nursed me at her breast till I was 7. That made my brothers jealous, so they stuffed me in a sack and sold me to a mummer's troop. When I tried to run off, the master mummer cut off half my nose, so I had no choice but to go with them and learn to be amusing." The truth was rather different. His uncle had taught him a bit of tumbling when he was 6 or 7. Tyrion had taken to it eagerly. For half a year he cartwheeled his merry way about Castle Rock, bringing smiles to the faces of septons, squires, and servants alike. Even Cersei laughed to see him once or twice. All that ended abruptly the day his father returned from a sojourn in King's Landing. That night at supper, Tyrion surprised his sire by walking the length of the high table on his hands. Lord Tywin was not pleased.
"The gods made you a dwarf. Must you be a fool as well? You were born a lion, not a monkey."
"And you're a corpse, father, so I'll caper as I please." "You have a gift for making men smile," Septa Lamor told Tyrion as he was drying off his toes. "You should thank the Father above. He gives gifts to all his children."
"He does," he agreed pleasantly.
"And when I die, please let them bury me with a crossbow, so I can thank the Father above for his gifts the same way I thank the Father below."
His clothing was still soaked from his involuntary swim, clinging to his arms and legs uncomfortably. Whilst young Griff went off with Septa Lamor to be instructed in the mysteries of the faith, Tyrion stripped off the wet clothes and donned dry ones. Duck had a good guffaw when he emerged on deck again. He could not blame him. Dressed as he was, he made a comic sight. His doublet was divided down the middle. The left side was purple velvet with bronze studs, the right yellow wool embroidered in green floral patterns. His breeches were similarly split. The right leg was solid green, the left leg striped in red and white. One of Illyrio's chests had been packed with a child's clothing, musty but well made. Septilamore had slit each garment apart, then sewn them back together, joining half of this to half of that, to fashion a crude motley. Griff had even insisted that Tyrion help with the cutting and sewing. No doubt he meant for it to be humbling, but Tyrion enjoyed the needlework. L'Amour was always pleasant company, despite her penchant for scolding him whenever he said something rude about the gods.
"If Griff wants to cast me as a fool, I'll play the game."
Somewhere he knew Lord Tywin Lannister was horrified, and that took the sting from it. His other duty was anything but foolish. Duck has his sword, I my quill and parchment. Griff had commanded him to set down all he knew of dragon lore. The task was a formidable one, but the dwarf laboured at it every day, scratching away as best he could as he sat cross-legged on the cabin roof. Tyrion had read much and more of dragons through the years. The greater part of those accounts were idle tales and could not be relied on, and the books that Illyrio had provided them were not the ones he might have wished for. What he really wanted was a complete text of the Fires of the Freehold, Galendro's History of Valyria. No complete copy was known to Westeros, however. Even the Citadel's library lacked 27 scrolls. They must have a library in Old Valentus, surely. I may find a better copy there. If I can find a way inside the black walls to the city's heart. He was less hopeful concerning Sept and Baths, dragons, worms, and wyverns, their unnatural history. Baath had been a blacksmith's son, who rose to be king's hand during the reign of Yaharis the Conciliator. His enemies always claimed he was more sorcerer than Septon. Baelor the Blessed had ordered all Baath's writings destroyed when he came to the Iron Throne. 10 years ago, Tyrion had read a fragment of unnatural history that had eluded the Blessed Baelor, but he doubted that any of Baath's work had found its way across the Narrow Sea, and of course there was even less chance of his coming on the fragmentary, anonymous, blood-soaked tome, sometimes called Blood and Fire, and sometimes The Death of Dragons, the only surviving copy of which was supposedly hidden away in a locked vault beneath the citadel. When the half-maester appeared on deck, yawning, the dwarf was writing down what he recalled concerning the mating habits of dragons, on which subject Baath, Munkin, and Tomax held markedly divergent views. Holden stalked to the stern, to piss down at the sun where it shimmered on the water, breaking apart with every puff of wind. "We should reach the junction with the Noyne by evening, Yellow," the half-maester called out. Tyrion glanced up from his writing. "My name is Hugo. Yellow is hiding in my breeches. Shall I let him out to play?"
Best not. You might frighten the turtles."
Holden's smile was as sharp as the blade of a dagger.
"What did you tell me was the name of that street in Lannisport where you were born, Yellow?"
"It was an alley. It had no name." Tyrion took a mortal pleasure in inventing the details of the colourful life of Hugo Hill, also known as Yellow, a bastard out of Lannisport.
"The best lies are seasoned with a bit of truth."
The dwarf knew he sounded like a Westerman, and a high-born Westerman at that, so Hugo must needs be some lordling's byblow. Born in Lannisport because he knew that city better than Old Town or King's Landing, and cities were where most dwarfs ended up, even those whelped by Goodwife Bumpkin in the turnip patch. The countryside had no grotesqueries or mummer shows, though it did have wells aplenty to swallow up unwanted kittens, three-headed calves, and babes like him.
"I see you have been defacing more good parchment, Yellow."
Holden laced up his breeches.
"Not all of us can be half a maester."
Tyrion's hand was cramping. He put his quill aside and flexed his stubby fingers.
"Fancy another game of Saivas?"
The half-maester always defeated him, but it was a way to pass the time. This evening, will you join us for young Griff's lesson? Why not? Someone needs to correct your errors. There were four cabins on the Shymaid. Yandri and Ysilla shared one, Griff and young Griff another. Scepter Lamore had a cabin to herself, as did Holden. The half-maester's cabin was the largest of the four. One wall was lined with bookshelves and bins stacked with old scrolls and parchments. Another held racks of ointments, herbs, and potions. Golden light slanted through the wavy yellow glass of the round window. The furnishings included a bunk, a writing desk, a chair, a stool, and the half-maester's Sivas table, strewn with carved wooden pieces. The lesson began with languages. Young Griff spoke the common tongue as if he'd been born to it, and was fluent in High Valyrian, the low dialects of Pentas, Tyrosh, Mir, and Lys, and the trade talk of sailors. The Volantine dialect was as new to him as it was to Tyrion, so every day they learned a few more words whilst Holland corrected their mistakes. Myrinese was harder. Its roots were Valyrian as well, but the tree had been grafted onto the harsh, ugly tongue of old Gis. "You need a bee up your nose to speak Giscari properly," Tyrion complained. Young Griff laughed, but the half-maester only said, "Again?" The boy obeyed, though he rolled his eyes along with his Z's this time. "He has a better ear than me," Tyrion was forced to admit, "though I'll wager my tongue is still more nimble." Geometry followed languages. There the boy was less adroit, but Holden was a patient teacher, and Tyrion was able to make himself of use as well. He had learned the mysteries of squares and circles and triangles from his father's maesters at Castle Rock, and they came back more quickly than he would have thought. By the time they turned to history, young Griff was growing restive. "We were discussing the history of Valentus," Holden said to him. "Can you tell Yolo the difference between a tiger and an elephant?"
"Valantis is the oldest of the nine free cities, first daughter of Valeria," the lad replied in a bored tone. "After the doom, it pleased the Volantines to consider themselves the heirs of the freehold and rightful rulers of the world. But they were divided as to how dominion might best be achieved. The old blood favoured the sword, while the merchants and moneylenders advocated trade. As they contended for rule of the city, the factions became known as the Tigers and Elephants, respectively. The Tigers held sway for almost a century after the doom of Valeria. For a time they were successful. A Volantine fleet took Lys, and a Volantine army captured Mir. And for two generations all three cities were ruled from within the Black Walls. That ended when the Tigers tried to swallow Tyrosh. Pentos came into the war on the Tyroshi side, along with their Westeroshi Storm King. Bravos provided a Lyseni exile with 100 warships. Aegon Targaryen flew forth from Dragonstone on the Black Dread, and Mir and Lys rose up in rebellion. The war left the disputed lands a waste and freed Lys and Mir from the yoke. The Tigers suffered other defeats as well. The fleet they sent to reclaim Valeria vanished in the smoking sea. Cahor and Norvus broke their power on the Roin when the fire galleys fought on Dagger Lake. Out of the east came the Dothraki, driving small folk from their hovels and nobles from their estates until only grass and ruins remained, from the forests of Cahor to the headwaters of the Salhoru. After a century of war, Valantis found herself broken, bankrupt, and depopulated. It was then that the elephants rose up. They have held sway ever since. Some years the Tigers elect a triarch, and some years they do not, but never more than one. So the elephants have ruled the city for 300 years.
Just so, said Holden. And the present triarchs?
Malachor is a tiger. Nysos and Doniphos are elephants. And what lesson can we draw from Volantine history? If you want to conquer the world, you best have dragons. Tyrion could not help but laugh. Later, when young Griff went up on deck to help Yandry with the sails and poles, Holden set up his Syvas table for their game. Tyrion watched with mismatched eyes and said, "The boy is bright. You have done well by him. Half the lords in Westeros are not so learned, sad to say. Languages, history, songs, sums, a heady stew for some sellsword son." "A book can be as dangerous as a sword in the right hands," said Holden. "Try to give me a better battle this time, Yellow. You play Syvas as badly as you tumble." "I am trying to lull you into a false sense of confidence," said Tyrion, as they arranged the tiles on either side of a carved wooden screen. "You think you taught me how to play, but things are not always as they seem. Perhaps I learn the game from the cheesemonger. Have you considered that?"
"Illyrio does not play Syvas."
"No," thought the dwarf. "He plays the Game of Thrones, and you and Griff and Duck are only pieces to be moved where he will and sacrificed at need, just as he sacrificed Viserys." "The blame must fall on you, then. If I play badly, it is your doing." The half-maester chuckled.
"Yellow, I shall miss you when the pirates cut your throat."
"Where are these famous pirates? I'm beginning to think that you and Illyrio made them all up."
"They are thickest on the stretch of river between Arnoy and the Sorrows. Above the ruins of Arnoy, the Corharic rule the river, and below the Sorrows, the galleys of Valantis hold sway. But neither city claims the waters in between, so the pirates have made it their own. Dagger Lake is full of islands where they lurk in hidden caves and secret strongholds. Are you ready?"
"For you? Oh, beyond a doubt. For the pirates, less so." Holden removed the screen. Each of them contemplated the other's opening array.
"You are learning," the half-maester said. Tyrion almost grabbed his dragon, but thought better of it. Last game he had brought her out too soon, and lost her to a trebuchet.
"If we do meet these fabled pirates, I may join up with them. I'll tell them that my name is Hugo Halfmaester."
He moved his light horse toward Holden's mountains. Holden answered with an elephant.
"Hugo Halfwit would suit you better." "I only need half my wits to be a match for you." Tyrion moved up his heavy horse to support the light. "Perhaps you would care to wager on the outcome." The half-maester arched an eyebrow.
"How much?"
"Well, I have no coin. We'll play for secrets."
"Griff would cut my tongue out."
"Afraid, are you? Oh, I would be if I were you. The day you defeat me at Syvas will be the day turtles crawl out my arse."
The half-maester moved his spears.
"You have your wager, little man."
Tyrion stretched a hand out for his dragon. It was 3 hours later when the little man finally crept back up on deck to empty his bladder. Duck was helping Yandry wrestle down the sail, while Ysilla took the tiller. The sun hung low above the reed beds along the western bank as the wind began to gust and rip. "I need that skin of wine," the dwarf thought. His legs were cramped from squatting on that stool, and he felt so light-headed that he was lucky not to fall into the river.
"Yellow," Doc called. "Where's Holden?"
"He's taken to his bed in some discomfort. There are turtles crawling out his ass." He left the knight to sort that out and crawled up the ladder to the cabin roof. Off to the east, there was darkness gathering behind a rocky island. Septa Lamor found him there.
"Can you feel the storms in the air, Hugo Hill? Dagger Lake is ahead of us where pirates prowl, and beyond that lie the Sorrows."
"Not mine. I carry mine own sorrows with me everywhere I go."
He thought of Tysha
and wondered where whores go. "Why not Volantis? Perhaps I'll find her there. A man should cling to hope." He wondered what he would say to her. "I am sorry that I let them rape you, love. I thought you were a whore. Can you find in your heart to forgive me? I want to go back to our cottage, to the way it was when we were man and wife." The island fell away behind them. Tyrion saw ruins rising along the eastern bank, crooked walls and fallen towers, broken domes and rows of rotted wooden pillars, streets choked by mud and overgrown with purple moss. Another dead city, 10 times as large as Goyendro. Turtles live there now, big bone snappers. The dwarf could see them, basking in the sun, brown and black hummocks with jagged ridges down the centres of their shells. A few saw the shy maid and slid down into the water, leaving ripples in their wake. This would not be a good place for a swim. Then, through the twisted, half-drawn trees and wide, wet streets, he glimpsed the silvery sheen of sunlight upon water. Another river, he knew at once, rushing towards the Rhône. The ruins grew taller as the land grew narrower, until the city ended on a point of land where stood the remains of a colossal palace of pink and green marble, its collapsed domes and broken spires looming large above a row of covered archways. Tyrion saw more snappers sleeping in the slips, where 50 ships might once have docked. He knew where he was then. That was Nymeria's palace, and this is all that remains of Nysa, her city. "Yellow!" shouted Yandri, as the shy maid passed the point. "Tell me again of those Westerosi rivers, as big as Mother Rhône." "I did not know," he called back. "No river in the 7 kingdoms is half so wide as this." The new river that had joined them was a close twin to the one they had been sailing down, and that one alone had almost matched the Mander or the Trident. "This is Nysa, where the mother gathers in her wild daughter Noin," said Yandri. "But she will not reach her widest point until she meets her other daughters. At Dagger Lake, the coin comes rushing in, the Darkland daughter full of gold and amber from the axe, and pine cones from the forest of Kohor. South of there, the mother meets Lerulu, the smiling daughter from the golden fields. Where they join, once stood Croyane, the festival city, where the streets were made of water and the houses made of gold. Then south and east again for long leagues until at last comes creeping in Selharu, the shy daughter who hides her course in reeds and rise. There Mother Rhône waxes so wide that a man upon a boat in the centre of the stream cannot see a shore to either side. Oh, you shall see, my little friend." "I shall," the dwarf was thinking, when he spied a rippling ahead, not 6 yards from the boat. He was about to point it out to Lamor when it came to the surface with a wash of water that rocked the shy maid sideways. It was another turtle, a horned turtle of enormous size, its dark green shell mottled with brown and overgrown with water moss and crusty Black River mollusks. It raised its head and bellowed, a deep-throated, thrumming roar, louder than any war horn that Tyrion had ever heard. "We are blessed," Ysilla was crying loudly, as tears streamed down her face. "We are blessed! We are blessed!" Duck was hooting, and young Griff too. Holden came out on deck to learn the cause of the commotion. But too late. The giant turtle had vanished below the water once again. "What was the cause of all that noise?" the half-maester asked. "A turtle," said Tyrion, "a turtle bigger than this boat."
"It was him," said Yantri, "the old man of the river."
"And why not?" Tyrion grinned. "Gods and wonders always appear to attend the birth of kings."
Davos. The merry midwife stole into White Harbour on the evening tide, her patch sail rippling with every gust of wind. She was an old cog, and even in her youth no one had ever called her pretty. Her figurehead showed a laughing woman holding an infant by one foot, but the woman's cheeks and the babe's bottom were both pocked by wormholes. Uncounted layers of drab brown paint covered her hull. Her sails were grey and tattered. She was not a ship to draw a second glance, unless it was to wonder how she stayed afloat. The merry midwife was known in White Harbour, too. For years she had plied a humble trade between there and Sisterton. It was not the sort of arrival that Davos Seaworth had anticipated when he'd set sail with Sala in his fleet. All this had seemed simpler then. The ravens had not brought King Stannis the allegiance of White Harbour, so his grace would send an envoy to treat with Lord Manderley in person. As a show of strength, Davos would arrive aboard Sala's Gallius Valerian, with the rest of the Lycian fleet behind her. Every hull was striped, black and yellow, pink and blue, green and white, purple and gold. The Lycini loved bright hues, and Salador Saun was the most colourful of all. Salador the Splendid, Davos thought, but the storms wrote an end to all of that. Instead he would smuggle himself into the city, as he might have done 20 years before. Until he knew how matters stood here, it was more prudent to play the common sailor, not the lord. White Harbour's walls of whitewashed stone rose before them, on the eastern shore where the White Knife plunged into the Firth. Some of the city's defences had been strengthened since the last time Davos had been here, half a dozen years before. The jetty that divided the inner and outer harbours had been fortified with a long stone wall, 30 feet tall and almost a mile long, with towers every 100 yards. There was smoke rising from Seal Rock as well, where once there had been only ruins.
That could be good or bad, depending on what side Lord Wyman chooses.
Davos had always been fond of the city, since first he'd come here as a cabin boy on Cobblecat. Though small compared to Old Town and King's Landing, it was clean and well-ordered, with wide, straight cobble streets that made it easier for a man to find his way. The houses were built of whitewashed stone, with steeply pitched roofs of dark grey slate. Roro Euhorus, the Cobblecat's cranky old master, used to claim that he could tell one port from another just by the way they smelled. Cities were like women, he insisted. Each one of them has its own unique scent. Old Town was as flowery as a perfumed dowager. Lannisport was a milkmaid, fresh and earthy, with wood smoke in her hair. King's Landing reeked like some unwashed whore, but White Harbour's scent was sharp and salty, and a little fishy, too.
"She smells the way a mermaid ought to smell," Roro said. "She smells of the sea."
"She still does," thought Davos, but he could smell the peat smoke drifting off Seal Rock, too. The sea stone dominated the approaches to the outer harbour, a massive grey-green upthrust looming 50 feet above the waters. Its top was crowned with a circle of weathered stones, a ring fort of the first men that had stood desolate and abandoned for hundreds of years. It was not abandoned now. Davos could see scorpions and spitfires behind the standing stones, and crossbowmen peering between them.
"It must be cold up there, and wet."
On all his previous visits, seals could be seen basking on the broken rocks below. The blind bass had always made him count them whenever the Cobblecat set sail from White Harbour. The more seals there were, Roro said, the more luck they would have on their voyage. There were no seals now. The smoke and the soldiers had frightened them away.
"A wiser man would see a caution in that. Oh, if I had a thimbleful of sense, I would have gone with Sala.
He could have made his way back south to Maria and their sons.
I have lost 4 sons in the king's service, and my 5th serves as his squire. I should have the right to cherish the 2 boys who still remain. It's been too long since I saw them."
At Eastwatch, the Black Brothers told him there was no love between the Mandalays of White Harbor and the Boltons of the Dreadfort. The Iron Throne had raised Roose Bolton up to Warden of the North. So it stood to reason that Wyman Mandalay should declare for Stannis.
"White Harbor cannot stand alone. The city needs an ally, a protector. Lord Wyman needs King Stannis as much as Stannis needs him."
Or so it seemed at Eastwatch. Sisterton had undermined those hopes. If Lord Borrell told it true, if the Mandalays meant to join their strength to the Boltons and the Freys, no, he would not dwell on that. He would know the truth soon enough. He prayed he had not come too late.
"That jetty wall conceals the inner harbor," he realized as the merry midwife was pulling down her sail.
The outer harbor was larger, but the inner harbor offered better anchorage, sheltered by the city wall on one side and the looming mass of the wolf's den on another, and now by the jetty wall as well. At Eastwatch by the sea, Cotter Pike told Davos that Lord Wyman was building war galleys. There could have been a score of ships concealed behind those walls, waiting only a command to put to sea. Behind the city's thick white walls, the new castle rose proud and pale upon its hill. Davos could see the domed roof of the Sept of the Snows as well, surmounted by tall statues of the 7. The Mandalays had brought the faith north with them when they were driven from the Reach. White Harbor had its God's Wood, too, a brooding tangle of root and branch and stone locked away behind the crumbling black walls of the Wolf's Den, an ancient fortress that served only as a prison now, but for the most part the Septons ruled here. The merman of House Mandalay was everywhere in evidence, flying from the towers of the new castle above the Seal Gate and along the city walls. At Eastwatch, the Northmen insisted that White Harbor would never abandon its allegiance to Winterfell, but Davos saw no sign of the direwolf of Stark.
"There are no lions either. Lord Wyman cannot have declared for Tywin yet, or he would have raised his standard."
The dockside wharfs were swarming. A clutter of small boats were tied up along the fish market, offloading their catches. He saw 3 river runners, too, long lean boats built tough to brave the swift currents and rocky chutes of the White Knife. It was the sea-going vessels that interested him most, however, a pair of carracks as drab and tattered as the Merry Midwife, the Trading Galley, Storm Dancer, the Cog's Brave Magister and Horn of Plenty, a galleas from Braavos marked by her purple hull and sails, and there, beyond, the warship. The sight of her sent a knife through his hopes. Her hull was black and gold, her figurehead a lion with an upraised paw. "Lion Star," read the letters on her stern, beneath a fluttering banner that bore the arms of the boy king on the Iron Throne. A year ago he would not have been able to read them, but Maester Pylos had taught him some of letters back on Dragonstone. For once the reading gave him little pleasure. Davos had been praying that the galley had been lost in the same storms that had ravaged Sala's fleet, but the guards had not been so kind. The Freys were here, and he would need to face them. The Merry Midwife tied up to the end of a weathered wooden pier in the outer harbour, well away from Lionstar. As her crew made her fast to the pilings and lowered a gangplank, her captain sauntered up to Davos. Casso Mogat was a mongrel of the narrow sea, fathered on a Sisterton whore by an Ebenese whaler. Only 5 feet tall and very hirsute, he dyed his hair and whiskers a mossy green. It made him look like a tree stump in yellow boots. Despite his appearance, he seemed a good sailor, though a hard master to his crew.
How long will you be gone?
A day at least, maybe longer.
Davison found that lords like to keep you waiting. They did it to make you anxious, he suspected, and to demonstrate their power.
The midwife will linger here 3 days, no longer. They will look for me back in Sisterton.
If things go well, I can be back by the morrow.
And if things go badly?
Oh, I may not be back at all. You need not wait for me.
A pair of customs men were clambering aboard as he went down the gangplank, but neither gave him so much as a glance. They were there to see the captain and inspect the hole. Common seamen did not concern them, and few men looked as common as Davis. He was a middling height. His shrewd peasant's face, weathered by wind and sun, his grizzled beard and brown hair well salted with grey. His garb was plain as well, old boots, brown breeches, and blue tunic, a woolen mantle of undyed wool, fastened with a wooden clasp. He wore a pair of salt-stained leather gloves to hide the stubby fingers of the hand that Stannis had shortened so many years ago. Davos hardly looked a lord, much less a king's hand. That was all to the good, until he knew how matters stood here. He made his way along the wharf and through the fish market. The brave magister was taking on some mead. The casks stood 4 high along the pier. Behind one stack, he glimpsed 3 sailors throwing dice. Farther on, the fishwives were crying the day's catch, and a boy was beating time on a drum as a shabby old bear danced in a circle for a ring of river runners. 2 spearmen had been posted at the seal gate, with a badge of House Manderley upon their breasts, but they were too intent on flirting with the dockside whore to pay Davos any mind. The gate was open, the portcullis raised. He joined the traffic passing through. Inside was a cobbled square with a fountain at its center. A stone merman rose from its waters, 20 feet tall, from tail to crown. His curly beard was green and white with lichen, and one of the prongs of his trident had been broken off before Davos had been born, yet somehow he still managed to impress. Old Fishfoot was what the locals called him. The square was named for some dead lord, but no one ever called it anything but Fishfoot Yard. The yard was teeming this afternoon. A woman was washing her small clothes in Fishfoot's fountain and hanging them off his trident to dry. Beneath the arches of the peddler's colonnade, the scribes and money changers had set up for business, along with a hedge wizard, a herb woman, and a very bad juggler. A man was selling apples from a barrow, and a woman was offering herring with chopped onions. Chickens and children were everywhere underfoot. The huge oak and iron doors of the old mint had always been closed when Davos had been in Fishfoot Yard before, but today they stood open. Inside he glimpsed hundreds of women, children, and old men huddled on the floor on piles of furs. Some had little cook fires going. Davos stopped beneath the colonnade and traded a halfpenny for an apple.
"Are people living in the old mint?"
he asked the apple seller.
"Them as have no other place to live, small folk, from up the White North, most of them. Ornwood's people, too. With that bastard of Bolton running loose, they all want to be inside the walls. I don't know what his lordship means to do with all of them. Most turned up with no more than the rags on their backs."
Davos felt a pang of guilt.
"They came here for refuge, to a city untouched by the fighting, and here I turn up to drag them back into the war."
He took a bite of the apple and felt guilty about that as well.
"How do they eat?"
The apple seller shrugged.
"Some beg, some steal, lots of young girls taking up the trade, the way girls always do when it's all they got to sell. Any boy stands 5 feet tall can find a place in his lordship's barracks, long as he can hold a spear."
"He's raising men, then?"
That might be good or bad, depending. The apple was dry and mealy, but Davis made himself take another bite.
"Does Lord Wyman mean to join the bastard?"
"Well," said the apple seller,
"the next time his lordship comes down here, hunting for an apple, I'll be sure and ask him. I hear his daughter was to wed some fray." "His granddaughter? I heard that too, but his lordship forgot to invite me to the wedding." "Here, you going to finish that? I'll take the rest back. Them seeds is good."
Davis tossed him back the core.
"A bad apple, but it was worth half a penny to learn that Manderley is raising men."
He made his way around Old Fishfoot, past where a young girl was selling cups of fresh milk from her nanny goat. He was remembering more of the city now that he was here. Down past where Old Fishfoot's Triton pointed was an alley where they sold fried cod, crisp and golden brown outside and flaky white within. Over there was a brothel, cleaner than most, where a sailor could enjoy a woman without fear of being robbed or killed. Off the other way, in one of those houses that clung to the walls of the wolf's den, like barnacles to an old hull, there used to be a brewhouse where they made a black beer so thick and tasty that a cask of it could fetch as much as Arbor Gold in Braavos and the Port of Ibbon, provided the locals left the brewer any to sell. It was wine he wanted, though, sour, dark, and dismal. He strolled across the yard and down a flight of steps to a wine sink called the Lazy Eel underneath a warehouse full of sheepskins. Back in his smuggling days, the Eel had been renowned for offering the oldest whores and vilest wine in White Harbour, along with meat pies full of lard and gristle that were inedible on their best days and poisonous on their worst. With fare like that, most locals shunned the place, leaving it for sailors who did not know any better. You never saw a city guardsman down in the Lazy Eel or a customs officer. Some things never changed. Inside the Eel, time stood still. The barrel-vaulted ceiling was stained black with soot. The floor was hard-packed earth. The air smelled of smoke and spoiled meat and stale vomit. The fat tallow candles on the tables gave off more smoke than light, and the wine that Davis ordered looked more brown than red in the gloom. Four whores were seated near the door, drinking. One gave him a hopeful smile as he entered. When Davis shook his head, the woman said something that made her companions laugh. After that, none of them paid him any mind. Aside from the whores and the proprietor, Davis had the Eel to himself. The cellar was large, full of nooks and shadowed alcoves, where a man could be alone. He took his wine to one of them and sat with his back to a wall to wait. Before long, he found himself staring at the hearth. The red woman could see the future in the fire, but all that Davis Seaworth ever saw were the shadows of the past, the burning ships, the fiery chain, the green shadows flashing across the belly of the clouds, the red keep brooding over all. Davis was a simple man, raised up by chance and war and Stannis. He did not understand why the gods would take four lads as young and strong as his sons, yet spare their weary father. Some nights he thought he had been left to rescue Edric Storm, but by now King Robert's bastard boy was safe in the Stepstones, yet Davis still remained.
"Do the gods have some other task for me?" he wondered. "If so, White Arbor may be some part of it."
He tried the wine, then poured half his cup onto the floor beside his foot. As dusk fell outside, the benches at the Eel began to fill with sailors. Davis called to the proprietor for another cup. When he brought it, he brought him a candle, too.
"You want food?" the man asked. "We got meat pies."
"What kind of meat is in them?"
"The usual kind. It's good."
The whores laughed.
"It's grey, he means," one said. "Shut your bloody yap. You eat 'em." "I eat all kinds of shit. Don't mean I like it."
Davis blew the candle out as soon as the proprietor moved off and sat back in the shadows. Seamen were the worst gossips in the world when the wine was flowing, even wine as cheap as this. All he need do was listen. Most of what he heard he'd learned in Sisterton, from Lord Godric or the denizens of the Belly of the Whale. Tywin Lannister was dead, butchered by his dwarf son. His corpse had stunk so badly that no one had been able to enter the Grey Sept of Baelor for days afterwards. The Lady of the Eyrie had been murdered by a singer. Littlefinger ruled the Vale now, but Bronze Yon Royce had sworn to bring him down. Balon Greyjoy had died as well, and his brothers were fighting for the Seastone Chair. Sandor Clegane had turned outlaw and was plundering and killing in the lands along the Trident. Myr and Lys and Tyrosh were embroiled in another war. A slave revolt was raging in the east. Other tidings were of greater interest. Robert Glover was in the city and had been trying to raise men with little success. Lord Manderley had turned a deaf ear to his pleas. White Harbour was weary of war, he was reported to have said. That was bad. The Risewells and the Dustins had surprised the Iron Men on the Fever River and put their longships to the torch. That was worse, and now the bastard Bolton was riding south with Hotha Umber to join them for an attack on Moat Cailin. "The Horsebane, his own self," claimed a riverman who'd just brought a load of hides and timber down the White Knife, "with 300 spearmen and 100 archers. Some Hornwood men have joined them, and Serwyn's too." That was worst of all.
"Lord Wyman best send some men to fight if he knows what's good for him," said the old fellow at the end of the table.
"Lord Bruce, he's the warden now. White Arbor's honour bound to answer his summons."
"What did any Bolton ever know of honour?" said the ale's proprietor as he filled their cups with more brown wine.
"Lord Wyman won't go no place. He's too bloody fat.
I heard how he was ailing. All he does is sleep and weep, they say. He's too sick to get out of his bed most days."
"Too fat, you mean?"
"Fat or thin's got nought to do with it," said the eel's proprietor. "The lion's got his son."
No one spoke of King Stannis. No one even seemed to know that his grace had come north to help defend the wall. Wildlings and wights and giants had been all the talk at Eastwatch, but here no one seemed to be giving them so much as a thought. Davis leaned into the firelight.
"I thought the Freys killed his son. That's what we heard in Sisterton."
"They killed Sir Wendell," said the proprietor. "His bones are resting in the snowy sept with candles all around them, if you want to have a look. Sir Willis, though, is still a captive."
"Worse and worse."
He had known that Lord Wyman had two sons, but he thought that both of them were dead.
"If the Iron Throne as a hostage..."
Davis had fathered 7 sons himself, and lost 4 on the Blackwater. He knew he would do whatever gods or men required of him to protect the other 3. Stefan and Stannis were thousands of leagues from the fighting, and safe from harm. But Devon was at Castle Black, a squire to the king.
"The king whose cause may rise or fall with White Arbor."
His fellow drinkers were talking about dragons now.
"You're bloody mad," said an oarsman off Storm Dancer. "The beggar king's been dead for years. Some Dothraki horse lord cut his head off."
"So they tell us," said the old fellow. "Might be they're lying, though. He died half a world away, if he died at all. Who's to say? If a king wanted me dead, might be I'd oblige him and pretend to be a corpse. None of us has ever seen his body."
"I never saw Joffrey's corpse, nor Robert's," growled the eel's proprietor. "Maybe they're all alive as well. Maybe Baelor the Blessed just been having him a little nap all these years."
The old fellow made a face,
Prince Viserys weren't the only dragon, were he? Are we sure they killed Prince Rhaegar's son? A babe he was.
Wasn't there some princess, too?
Asked a whore. She was the same one who'd said the meat was grey.
Two, said the old fellow. One was Rhaegar's daughter, t'other was his sister.
Dana, said the riverman, that was a sister, Dana of Dragonstone. Or was it Dara?
Dana was old King Baelor's wife, said the oarsman. I rode on a ship named for her once, the Princess Dana.
If she were a king's wife, she'd be a queen.
Baelor never had a queen. He was holy.
Don't mean he never wed his sister, said the whore. He just never bedded her, is all. When they made him king, he locked her up in a tower. His other sisters, too. There was three.
Danilla, the proprietor said loudly. That was her name. The mad king's daughter. I mean, not Baelor's bloody wife.
Daenerys, Davos said. She was named for the Daenerys who wed the Prince of Dawn during the reign of Daeron the Second. I don't know what became of her.
I do, said the man who started all the talk of dragons, a bravassy oarsman in a sombre woolen jack. When we were down to Pentos, we moored beside a trader called the Slow-Eyed Maid, and I got to drinking with a Captain Stewart. He told me a pretty tale about some slip of a girl who'd come aboard in Carth to try and book passage back to Westeros for her and three dragons. Silver hair she had and purple eyes. I took her to the captain me own self, this steward swore to me, but he wasn't having none of that. There's more profit in cloves and saffron, he tells me, and spices won't set fire to your sails.
Laughter swept the cellar. Davos did not join in. He knew what had befallen the slow-eyed maid. The gods were cruel to let a man sail half across the world, to send him chasing a false light when he was almost home.
That captain was a bolder man than me, he thought, as he made his way to the door.
One voyage to the east, and a man could live as rich as a lord until the end of his days. When he'd been younger, Davos had dreamed of making such voyages himself, but the years went dancing by like moths around a flame, and somehow the time had never been quite right.
One day, he told himself, one day when the war is done, and King Stannis sits the Iron Throne, and has no more need of onion knights, I'll take Devon with me, Steph and Stanny too, if they're old enough. We'll see these dragons and all the wonders of the world.
Outside, the wind was gusting, making the flames shiver in the oil lamps that lit the yard. It had grown colder since the sun went down, but Davos remembered Eastwatch and how the wind would come screaming off the wall at night, knifing through even the warmest cloak to freeze a man's blood right in his veins. White Harbor was a warm bath by comparison. There were other places he might get his ears filled. An inn famous for its lamprey pies, the alehouse where the wool factors and the customs men did their drinking, a mama's hall where bawdy entertainments could be had for a few pennies. But Davos felt that he'd heard enough.
I've come too late.
Old instinct made him reach for his chest, where once he kept his finger bones in a little sack on a leather thong. There was nothing there. He had lost his luck in the fires of the Blackwater when he'd lost his ship and sons.
What must I do now?
He pulled his mantle tighter.
Do I climb the hill and present myself at the gates of the new castle to make a futile plea? Return to Sisterton? Make my way back to Maria and my boys? Buy a horse and ride the King's Road to tell Stannis that he has no friends in White Harbor and no hope?
Queen Selyse had feasted Sala and his captains the night before the fleet had set sail. Cutter Pike had joined them, and four other high officers of the Night's Watch. Princess Shireen had been allowed to attend as well. As the salmon was being